In this session, we're going to have an introduction to the book of 1 Kings and actually 2 Kings, because the two, as we mentioned earlier when we were talking about Samuel, the two books of Samuel were originally one book, and the two books of Kings were originally one book. And as a matter of fact, the two books of Chronicles were originally one book. We have two each of these books. Largely, we can thank the Septuagint translators for that. The Hebrew Bible originally just had one book that we call the books of Samuel now, one book that we call the books of Kings, and one book that we call the books of Chronicles. These were, in the Septuagint, broken up into books, what they called the books of kingdoms. That is, the first and second Samuel were called the first and second books of kingdoms. And 1 and 2 Kings were called the second, or the third and fourth books of kingdoms. And they broke them into two parts, mainly for mechanical reasons. The Hebrew text did not have vowels, and so the words didn't take up as much space as the Greek text took, because the Greek text did have vowels. And so the words were longer and took more space, so they had to break them up into smaller books. Now, so we could talk about the books of Kings, or the book of Kings. We're really talking about one document written by one person and not two books. But the books of Kings cover the entire period from the death of David at the beginning of 1 Kings to the death of the nation at the end of 2 Kings. David was the most glorious king in Israel's history. And so from his death, everything began to decline. Not rapidly, because Solomon's reign still retained a great deal of glory from David's time. When David died, he left Israel probably as rich as it ever was in any time of its history. When Solomon left power, he'd impoverished the nation a great deal. He'd built some beautiful buildings and had a glorious empire that looked good, but he had done so at great expense. And with a lot of slave labor and so forth. And a lot of the people were in bad shape economically, so that when Solomon himself died and left his kingdom to his son Rehoboam, the people complained to Rehoboam about the oppressive nature of Solomon's taxation and of Solomon's civic projects, and said, you know, if you just reduce the level of taxation, we'll serve you as we served your father. But if you don't, we're going to not serve you. And so it was because Rehoboam did not comply with the people's request that there was a revolt and the kingdom divided into two. From that point on, essentially the books of Kings tell us the parallel histories of two different kingdoms, one to the north and one to the south, the one in the north called Israel, the one in the south called Judah. And the death of the nation took place in stages. We could call the division of the kingdom into two as part of its deterioration. And that happened in Rehoboam's time. Much later, the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians in 721 or 722 BC. And that was the end of the northern kingdom. And all that remained was the kingdom of Judah in the south. And it remained for another 135 years until 586 BC. And then it was taken into captivity in Babylon. And that was basically the end of the nation. Of course, Judah returned from Babylon later on, but not entirely. Only a remnant returned. They did rebuild the temple, and they rebuilt things, and that's not part of the books of Kings. The books of Kings just take us up to the point where Judah went into captivity, and therefore the nation has been split, and then each individual part of the nation has fallen to foreign powers by the end of this document of 2 Kings. The record actually begins with Solomon's reign and his temple building project. And the 2 Kings ends with the burning and destruction of the temple. So in a sense, the books of Kings are the history of the temple period, the first temple period. There's 47 chapters. And through most of them, the temple is standing. It's early in the book, around chapter 5 of 1 Kings. Solomon's making preparations to build the temple, and then he builds it in chapters 6 through 8. And then the temple is standing and central to the life of Judah, and much of the time of Israel too, at least some of the time, and is there until its destruction in 586. So these 47 chapters are mostly covering a time when the temple was standing and when it was the central issue in Jewish life. That is what we call the first temple period. Later, after the Babylonian exile, in a period that we will read about in later books of Ezra and Nehemiah, the temple was rebuilt by Zerubbabel and by the remnant of the Jews that came back from Babylon with him. And it stood until AD 70, when it was destroyed also. So there's been two temples. And we sometimes refer to the temple of Zerubbabel and its later embellishment by Herod as the Second Temple period. Sometimes scholars talk about Second Temple Judaism, having different features, different kinds of worship and so forth than in First Temple or in pre-temple in Tabernacle Judaism. Judaism went through changes in these different periods of time, and even the temple innovated some changes from what had been in the tabernacle, but apparently God didn't mind. In fact, in the book of Chronicles, we're told that David had received plans for this temple through the Spirit, through inspiration. So just as Moses had seen a vision, a pattern for the tabernacle when he was up on Mount Sinai, David apparently received divine revelation for the design of the temple, which he then passed down to his son Solomon. And we don't know to what degree Solomon followed. He seems to have followed it pretty much, although he did employ architects and workers from Phoenicia to come and have some kind of role in its, probably in its design, certainly in its structure. And so as we saw that the book of First Chronicles largely paralleled the books of Samuel, so the book of Second Chronicles, for the most part, parallels the books of Kings. Not exactly, but if you look at the back of the sheet I've given you, I've given essentially all the parallel passages between Kings and Chronicles, and you can see that the first few chapters of Kings are paralleled in First Chronicles. So the parallels are not exact, but you know, it doesn't divide up really between Samuel and Kings quite perfectly between the two books of Chronicles. But of course, the two books of Chronicles were divided somewhat artificially. It's not as if, you know, First Chronicles was written separately than Second Chronicles in order to parallel different books. Chronicles was all one book, and so its division is a little bit arbitrary, but it just so happens that as it was divided, most of Kings is paralleled in Second Chronicles. And we'll say more about Chronicles. We've actually had at another time an introduction to the books of Chronicles, but as we go through the books of Kings, we'll try to bring in the additional material that Chronicles gives us about the same period. If you'll notice on the back of the sheet I gave you, there are significant omissions in 2 Chronicles vis-a-vis the books of Kings, and there are additions that Chronicles includes that the books of Kings leave out. I haven't listed a complete list of omissions, but I have mentioned that one of the main things absent from Chronicles in giving this history that is found and very prominent in Kings is the ministries of Elijah and Elisha. The ministries of Elijah and Elisha are very prominent in the books of Kings. Probably, I'm going to say, more than a third of the chapters of 1 and 2 Kings span the ministries of Elijah and Elisha, two major characters in the books of Kings, absent entirely from the books of Chronicles. But as far as additions that Chronicles includes that are not found in the books of Kings, there are some things important. I've listed several of them, and we will look at those as we're going through Kings. We'll turn to these passages and Chronicles in the proper place and supplement the information there. But there's especially interesting is that although 1 Chronicles, when it was paralleling the books of Samuel, left out some of the embarrassing things about David. For example, left out the sin with Bathsheba. And Chronicles didn't include that, but Chronicles did include some embarrassing things about the good kings. That Kings, the book of Kings mentions the good kings, but without going into any detail about the things they do wrong. Like Asa, who was essentially a good king of Judah, he put a prophet in prison for rebuking him. Hanani, the prophet, rebuked him for his compromises, and he put the prophet in prison in chapter 2 Chronicles 16, 7 through 10. Asa was also, though a good king, struck by God with or cursed by God because he did not seek the Lord, but he sought physicians for an ailment in his feet in chapter 16, verse 12. Chronicles mentions that, but Kings does not. Kings does mention that he was afflicted in his feet, but it doesn't mention that he sought physician's aid instead of God's aid. There's some good things about Jehoshaphat that are found in Chronicles that are not found in the books of Kings. Jehoshaphat was a good king, and we know that from the book of Kings, but there's somewhat more extensive description of Jehoshaphat's reforms and also of a significant war in which Jehoshaphat turned to the Lord when he was overwhelmed by Moabite and Ammonite invaders. And that was the war where God just told him to send the singers and the musicians out ahead of the troops. And so the musicians were singing and worshiping God out in the battlefield, and God turned the enemy against each other, and the enemy killed each other. And so it was like a supernatural victory. And that is found only in 2 Chronicles, not in Kings. That's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. There's a very strange and difficult to explain detail in 2 Chronicles. It's not in Kings. It's in chapter 21, verses 11 through 19. And it's a letter from Elijah the prophet that came to a king much later than the time of Elijah's departure from the earth. Elijah was caught up into heaven years earlier than this letter is said to have been sent. And so the scholars have been very puzzled over this. And some think it's an anachronism. Some think it's a fabrication. Some think that Elijah actually sent a letter from heaven. I think the rabbis believe that. Elijah gone to heaven, sent a letter down to the king. Some think he had written the letter in his lifetime prophetically to be given to a king who had not yet been born. And I suppose another possibility, though maybe a far-fetched one, is it's a different Elijah. But there is this one detail in 2 Chronicles that's not found in Kings, where the prophet Elijah sends a letter to King Jehoram. Now, Joash, who was a promising young king, actually ended up apostatizing, sadly, and murdering his cousin Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, which was not mentioned in Kings, but is mentioned by Jesus when Jesus talked about Zechariah, who was killed between the temple and the altar. That was this Zechariah who was killed by his cousin King Joash, who had earlier been a good king. Also, Uzziah, who is a good king, does not mention in Kings, but does in Chronicles chapter 26, that Uzziah got leprosy because he tried to unlawfully burn incense. And so he came under judgment from God. Now, Hezekiah was a good king, and in chapter 29 and 30 of 2 Chronicles, we have details about his reforms, his restoration of the temple, and an elaborate celebration of the Passover, which are left out of Kings. That's included in 2 Chronicles. And perhaps one of the most interesting things that Chronicles includes that is left out of Kings is a detail about the later years of Manasseh's reign. Because Manasseh was a wicked king. In fact, according to the book of Kings, Manasseh was the worst king ever. And it is because of Manasseh's wickedness that the nation came under judgment when in Babylon, even though later kings were not as bad as he was, and particularly Josiah was a good king and came afterwards. And the Bible says that God was pleased with Josiah's reforms, but not pleased enough to stop the judgment that was coming because of Manasseh's earlier wickedness. So Manasseh is a very wicked king, as the books of Kings tell us, but Chronicles tells us that he was taken into captivity, and in captivity he humbled himself, and he repented before God, and he changed. Now, Kings doesn't tell us about this repentance and restoration of Manasseh. Kings only gives us the story about his wickedness because it was so significant in bringing the downfall of the nation. But Manasseh had earlier in his life actually caused his sons to be burned to Molech. But when he was taken into captivity and he repented and humbled himself and God released him, he then reformed. And he sought to tear down and eliminate Molech worship and so forth. He tried to, you know, make amends for his evil deeds. And that is something that chapter 33 of 2 Chronicles, verses 10 through 17, records for us, but Kings does not. And there's other things I didn't mention just verbally just now, everything in the list. There's more things in your list, but those are things that I've always found somewhat interesting to have in Chronicles that Kings leaves out. There are other interesting things too, and even the list I gave you isn't complete. There are a lot of smaller details that Chronicles includes that are not found in Kings, but those are some of the larger issues. Well, what is the purpose of the writing of the books of Kings? I mean, why does someone undertake a project like that? Well, in my opinion, it would appear to me that the book of Kings was written to teach the lesson that Israel's national fortunes are directly tied to their loyalty and faithfulness, or lack thereof, to the covenant. The nation of Israel was established when God made a covenant with the slaves who had been brought out of Egypt. And they agreed to be faithful to him, and he agreed to be faithful to them. And although they, in the time of David and Solomon, became very great nations that could compete in their own right with any other nation around them for power and for wealth and all of that, yet they were still vulnerable to God's providence if they would be unfaithful to him. And therefore, the fortunes of the nation of Israel, especially more than any other nation, were tied directly to whether they were keeping God's covenant or not. And the lesson of the book is that as they broke the covenant, God caused them to decline into destruction of their nation. The book demonstrates how God raises up rulers and judges rulers and brings them down. And one of the things that's prominent in the book of Kings, as I've mentioned already, is the ministries of prophets, especially of Elijah and Elisha. In fact, if anything, one gets the impression from Kings that the role of Elijah and Elisha were more important to the security of the nation than anything the kings themselves did. Because Elijah and Elisha are both referred to as the chariots of Israel, meaning the defense, the power of Israel. Elisha refers to Elijah that way, and Elisha himself is later referred to that way by the king when he's on his deathbed. And so it would appear that the prophets play a larger role in the fortunes of the country than the kings do, because the prophets are there to bring the kings back to faithfulness to the covenant when the kings typically go astray, and they do most of the time. Now, who wrote the books of Kings? Well, there's a Jewish tradition that Jeremiah did. And it seems like that is probably the best theory. It's not unanimously held by scholars that Jeremiah did, of course. Nothing is unanimously held by scholars. But the Jewish tradition makes some sense. For one thing, he lived at the right time. The author lived long enough to see the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC, but apparently did not live long enough to see the return of the exiles. So it was sometime after the fall, but not after the return of the exiles that this was written. Jeremiah's life overlapped the decline and the fall of Jerusalem, and he lived a little beyond that time. So he lived at the right time frame to have written it. There are some near parallel or near identical parallel accounts in Jeremiah and in Kings, particularly 2 Kings 24, 18 through 25, 30. 2 Kings 24, 18 through 25, 30 are parallel almost verbatim with Jeremiah chapter 52, verses 1 through 34. In other words, it looks like one of the authors lifted material right out of the other one's book. It might be the same author, even. Some have thought that if Jeremiah didn't write it, maybe one of his own students did and used Jeremiah's written records, written prophecies, as part of his sources and just lifted a passage out of Jeremiah's book into 2 Kings. but it's as easy to suggest that Jeremiah may have done so himself. There are other sources of historical information, though, that the author had, and of course no author would have lived to see all the events, because the span of the events is hundreds of years long, and therefore he needed historical records to be able to tell of the stories of kings before his own time. And there are three other historical sources that the author mentions. Only once he mentions a book called The Book of the Acts of Solomon, and he mentions that in 1 Kings 11:41. But then there are frequent references to a couple of other books. One is called The Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, and one is the Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. This is, of course, after the kingdom was divided. And there are 17 references to each of these. 17 references to the Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, and 17 to the Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. Usually, it is in the setting where it's ending the story of one king. And as it's closing out his story, it says, now the rest of the acts of King so-and-so, are they not found in the Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, or of Israel, if it's an Israeli king. So that's we see these books were available to the author as apparently sources, or at least confirmatory documents. But we don't have them today. The Book of the Acts of Solomon and the two books of Chronicles of the Kings of Judah and of Israel are not the books that we have called Chronicles, and we don't have any surviving manuscripts of these old books that the author of Kings had reference to, or made reference to. Now, the book of 1 Kings, the division between 1 and 2 Kings is somewhat artificial, it's somewhat mechanical, but as it turned out, the book of 1 Kings is divided exactly in half. 11 chapters in the first half, 11 chapters in the second half, and almost the same number of pages in each half. Although chapters tend to be longer or shorter than each other, depending on how they've been divided up, yet the 11 chapters at the beginning of 1 Kings is almost the same number of pages as the 11 chapters at the end. And it's a natural division. The first 11 chapters of 1 Kings are about Solomon's reign. At the beginning, he is installed and established as the king. At the end, he dies, at the end of chapter 11. And he is the last king to reign his entire life over a united kingdom of Israel, because his son didn't reign for very long before the kingdom divided. And so only Saul, David, and Solomon really had the privilege of reigning over the whole kingdom of Israel through until their death. After that, the kingdom divided. But the first 11 chapters are the reign of Solomon, and they are dominated fairly heavily with the temple project that he built. A lot of details given about that. The second half, the last 11 chapters, chapters 12 through 22, are, of course, after the kingdom is divided. And so, like most of 2 Kings, it's occupied with giving the parallel histories of two different kingdoms moving back and forth from one to the other. Now, the book of 2 Kings has its major division quite late in the book. Its first section is chapters 1 through 17, which essentially continues the parallel histories of the two, the northern and southern kingdoms. So the first 17 chapters, or so, first 16 chapters, are just a continuation of 1 Kings and the same kind of material as you find in 1 Kings chapters 12 through 22, this parallel histories of these two kingdoms. But after chapter 17, 2 Kings doesn't have that anymore, because in chapter 17 the northern kingdom is destroyed and it doesn't exist anymore. And therefore the rest of the book is the fate of Judah, the last surviving portion of the kingdom. And the northern kingdom's total history lasted for 254 years. In that time they had 19 kings, not one good one. All the kings of Israel to the north were bad kings. They never got one good one. And that was over a period of 254 years. After the northern kingdom fell, the southern kingdom continued for another 135 years. They had a total of 20 kings, which, as you can see, means that on average, the kings of Judah reigned longer than the kings of Israel. Part of that is because the kings of Israel were so wicked, they were often taken out in bloody assassinations and coups and things like that. But that happened in the south too, somewhat. Now, of the kings in the south, most of them were bad also. But there are a few good ones. There's some refreshing stories of kings like Uzziah and Hezekiah and Josiah and Jehoshaphat. I mean, there's a few kings that were really, really good kings. But interestingly, all of them had some negative thing recorded against them before the end of their story. Even Hezekiah and Josiah, who seem to have been the very best kings that Judah had, each of them has some negative thing reported about him at the end of his life, which is sad. I mean, but in an age where almost everyone was wicked, being as good as they were was exceptional and is refreshing. So we have 19 bad kings in the north and 20 kings, mostly bad, in the south, and therefore it can be a bit depressing. The story is brightened, however. The enjoyment of the story is enhanced, I believe, by the presence of Elijah and Elisha the prophets. And I would say that the book of Kings gives a high place of prominence to prophets. In 1 Kings, we're looking at Elijah primarily, and he's the prominent prophet. In the second chapter of 2 Kings, he is carried up into heaven, and he is succeeded in his ministry by his servant Elisha. And so 2 Kings is mostly about Elisha. Together, these two men's ministries span about 20 chapters of the 47 chapters of the book. That's two-fifths of the record of Kings is occupied with these two men's lives. And when you figure that there's over, you know, almost 400 years covered in the period, that two-fifths of it would be given to two men's lifetimes would suggest the disproportionate importance of those two men. They were very significant prophets, a little bit like Moses in their significance. Not quite, but Moses and the prophets, or the law and the prophets forever afterward to the Jews, were significant to the point where the Messiah was said to be like another Moses, and the forerunner of the Messiah would be like another Elijah. And it was Moses and Elijah who appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus in the Gospels. And these two men, I mean, Elijah obviously held some kind of a role of esteem in the mind of Israel, similar to that of Moses. Different, because Moses was more of, although he was certainly a religious founder, he was also a political founder of the nation, a military deliverer and founder of a political nation and a giver of laws. Elijah was strictly a prophet, but he was an important prophet. And it's interesting that Elijah was not a writing prophet, because men like Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel and Amos and Hosea and those men who wrote books were not actually, apparently, at least the books of Kings don't treat them as being as significant as Elijah and Elisha. And yet Elijah and Elisha did not write books as far as we know. In addition to these two prophets, there are quite a few other prophets, named and unnamed, in the books of 1 Kings. There's Ahijah, the prophet. There's a prophet named Jehu. There's a prophet named Micaiah. And then Jonah and Isaiah are named in the book as characters, and we know them because they were writing prophets. Of all the prophets mentioned in the books of Kings, only Jonah and Isaiah were writing prophets. And then there are four other prophets throughout the story that are not named. They're anonymous. And there's a prophetess, a female prophet named Huldah. In addition to that, there are 100 prophets in the northern kingdom that are hidden by a man named Obadiah from Queen Jezebel, because she's been out slaughtering the prophets. There have been a lot of prophets, apparently. If she killed off almost all of them, but 100 of them got saved in a cave and were hidden there. And in Bethel, Jericho, and Gilgal, we find groups of prophets, sons of the prophets, as they're called. So we have a prominent visibility of these prophets in Israel, which were very important because almost all countries, if you read their political history, you're going to be reading about the people who held political offices, and you read that here. But the people who held the political offices in these stories seem to be mostly kind of morally stupid people, and sometimes stupid in their governing. At least they seem stupid to us. They might have been shrewd, they might have been even efficient in some cases as rulers, but they seem to be morally very stupid. And it was the prophets who were there to rebuke and to correct and to try to salvage the nation from the damage done by the foolish choices of the kings. And so throughout the book of Kings, we're going to have a lot of attention given to prophets. It makes it very interesting, frankly, much, much more interesting than a mere political history, to see, you know, God's word coming to these kings and evaluating their deeds, either commending them or rebuking them, just to see God interacting with a nation through prophets is, I mean, it'd be so great, in a sense, to live in a country where that was happening. Although, unfortunately, maybe the reason that God sent prophets is because the nation had such bad rulers. Maybe it's not so good to have a nation that needs prophets to tell the rulers to turn around all the time. But it'd be great to have a nation where the rulers could actually consult God through prophets and do the right thing all the time if they wished to. I'm not sure if we'd get any rulers that really wished to, but if you got some, like Hezekiah or whatever, it's certainly a desirable thing to have the word of the Lord available. Remember in Samuel's day, it said, when Samuel was a child, before the word of the Lord was coming to him, it says the word of the Lord was precious or rare in those days. There was no open vision. Samuel was the first of this order of prophets, and he also established an order of prophets in several towns, which were called the Company of Prophets or the Sons of the Prophets. And they are the ones that although a later generation of them in the same institution, are the ones that we find at Gilgal and Jericho and Bethel in the books of Kings, but generations later than Samuel's time. But Samuel apparently established an order of prophets, and that is what provided guidance for the nation, and not only guidance for the nation, but eventually provided the books that we call the Old Testament, because the books of the Old Testament, almost all of them, are written by prophets. And so they are very important in the nation's history and in our own spiritual lives as well. Now, we can look at an outline of the book of Kings, the two books of Kings. I mentioned the first 11 chapters of 1 Kings is concerned with the reign of Solomon. In chapters 1 through 4 of that section, we have Solomon established as the ruler. We have David still alive, but ailing and dying in the opening of the book of 1 Kings. He is old. His health has failed. He's only 70, but he seems to have aged prematurely because his body cannot generate heat. He's always cold, apparently his consumption or something. And so it begins with how this woman was sought to actually keep his bed warm for him. And actually, although he was a man with many women and plenty of sexual desire, he didn't have any sexual relations with this woman. She was chosen because she was the most beautiful woman they could find in the kingdom, a young virgin. And she remained a virgin the whole time that she kept his bed warm with him. But the reason that starts that way is because she becomes an issue later on when Adonijah, David's oldest surviving son at this time, wants to make himself king after David's death. He tried before David's death, and he apparently tried again after David died. He tried to do so by getting this woman, Abishag, to be his wife. And of course, as we've pointed out when we were going through Samuel, it was kind of a understood thing that the man who had the wives of the previous king was seen as the successor. So it was a political move on his part. So we're introduced to Abishag in connection with David right at the beginning of the book. And then Adonijah tries to make himself king. This doesn't work out for him. Solomon becomes king instead. Then David, on his deathbed, tells Solomon to kind of clean up some things that David left untidy. There are some bad people who should have been judged, And he leaves that to Solomon to take care of for him. And so Solomon does. And eventually Solomon's kingdom is established. By chapter 4, we're reading about how prosperous it was, how extensive his kingdom was, and how wise he was. Of course, it's in these early chapters also that he is told by God that he could ask for anything he wants and God will give it to him. And God, he asked for wisdom. And so God gave him wisdom greater than any other man of the time, but also gave him wealth, which he did not ask for, greater than any of his contemporaries. So that's how his kingdom was established, chapters 1 through 4. Then chapters 5 through 9 document a lot of the building projects that Solomon did, the temple being the most important of them, but he also built quite a few other civic works and a lot of buildings that are named and things he did. One of his chief claims to fame was his building projects. And of course, the temple that he built was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And it is described in chapters, it and the other projects, chapters 5 through 9. Then there's a chapter devoted to how wise Solomon was and how impressed, especially the Queen of Sheba and everyone else was, chapter 10. And then chapter 11 talks about how Solomon fell away from the Lord due to his taking too many wives from foreign nations and accommodating their religions more than he should in Jerusalem, building temples for their gods and goddesses and so forth. And thus they turned his heart away from God, the Bible says. And then he becomes a bad guy. Solomon becomes a bad guy. And God sends a prophet to tell him he's going to lose the kingdom altogether, or at least 10 of the tribes. And it becomes clear that sort of a foreman on one of his work crews, a guy named Jeroboam, is going to be the man who will succeed him to rule those 10 tribes. So Solomon tries to kill him, but he escapes to Egypt and stays there until after Solomon's death. And at the end of chapter 11, we see Solomon dies. So then we have from 1 Kings 12 through 2 Kings 17, we have the divided kingdom, we could call it. That's the second major section of these books. We have the reign of Solomon, first 11 chapters, then we have the divided kingdom. And begins in chapter 12 with the revolt of the 10 tribes against Rehoboam, and then the rise of idolatry in the northern kingdom as Jeroboam becomes the first king of the northern kingdom, and he sets up gold calves at Dan and Bethel to be sort of alternative places of worship so that his people will not go down to Jerusalem, which was ruled by Rehoboam. He didn't want them going back to Judah and rejoining under the house of David. And so he built alternative shrines with these gold calves. And that was the beginning of idolatry at that time in the northern kingdom. Then we have in chapter 13 of this section, a prophet, an unnamed prophet. He comes and he gives a really striking prophecy. He prophesies Josiah's reign by name, hundreds of years in advance of Josiah's birth, and gives a specific prediction of what something Josiah would do, which Josiah later did. And he curses an altar, a pagan altar that Jeroboam had set up. And there's this strange story about the older prophet who hears about him and deceives him, and that's all in that chapter. It's a strange story. We'll look at it, of course, in more detail later. And then in chapters 14 through 16, we basically have a succession of kings of the northern and southern kingdoms up until you get to Ahab. And Ahab is significant enough to detain the story for the rest of 1 Kings. From chapter 14 to the end of the book, it's the reign of Ahab, pretty much. I mean, he dies at the end of of chapter 22. So Ahab is significant. But he's significant because he's evil. He's significantly evil. He marries Jezebel, who's a princess from Phoenicia and a worshiper of Baal. And she's a nasty lady and a dominating lady. And he was an easy man to dominate. He was a bad king, but partly because he is a weak, spineless king, and he didn't. He probably worshipped Baal himself, probably happily enough, but he probably would not have enforced Baal worship on the country like his wife did. But she actually conducted a purge of all of Yahweh's prophets and brought prophets of Baal into the staff of the kingdom, of the monarchs. And so they were taking their counsel from prophets of Baal. And she was seeking to outlaw the worship of Yahweh in Israel. So she was a very significant threat to the faith in God in Israel in her time. And that's why so much time is given, so many chapters are given to that. And it is in that context that Elijah the prophet appears. And he comes and he declares there's going to be a drought until he says otherwise. And then he runs and hides because Jezebel's a dangerous lady. And she has basically a warrant out for his arrest and a price on his head. And so we have in chapter 17, Elijah, and his ministry continues until the death of Ahab in chapter 22. So 1 Kings chapters 17 through 22 are focused on the ministry of Elijah the prophet. And also another prophet named Micaiah is significant in the final chapter of Ahab's life. So that gets us to the end of 1 Kings. But the divided kingdom continues to be considered through the next several chapters at the beginning of 2 Kings. And at the beginning of 2 Kings, King Ahaziah of Israel is denounced by Elijah the prophet, and that king dies. And then that's basically Elijah's last action. And he is, in chapter 2, taken up into heaven, apparently alive, in a whirlwind. And Elisha, his servant, becomes his successor. And the ministry of Elisha becomes the focus of chapters 2 through 8. Now, in these chapters where they focus on the ministries of Elijah and Elisha, very little attention is given to the politics, to the kings. I mean, these kings, especially Ahab, you know, they figure in the story significantly, but there's a lot of other activities of Elijah and Elisha that don't have anything to do with the royalty, just things they're doing with other people in other places and so forth, and how God is using them. And so that's the case in chapters 2 through 8. Now, Elisha doesn't die until chapter 13. But after chapter 8, he kind of fades from view until it mentions his final words and his death in chapter 13. But chapters 2 through 8 are a focus on the ministry of Elisha. Significantly, in chapters 9 through 10, we have an uprising against the house of Omri, against Ahab and his seed, by one of his generals named Jehu. Actually, Elijah, the prophet, sent one of the lesser prophets to go anoint Jehu when he was still a military leader and say, you're the new king of Israel. And Jehu rose to that happily, and he went and he killed Jezebel. Ahab was already dead, but Jezebel was still there, and killed Ahab's son, who was the king, and also killed everyone he could get his hands on that was royalty. Unfortunately, even some of the royalty of Judah, at least some of the royal family of Judah, happened to be unlucky enough to be visiting the king of Israel, and they got themselves killed by Jehu. And then Jehu killed all the prophets of Baal. Jehu's rebellion and purge was very bloody, and it occupies 2 Kings chapters 9 and 10. Then we have the interesting story in chapter 11 of Athaliah, who's the daughter of Jezebel and has married into the royal family of Judah. Now, Jezebel's the queen of the northern kingdom, but her daughter Athaliah marries into the kingdom of Judah and to Jehoshaphat's son, and she takes advantage of the crisis in the north and Jehu's purge, and she kills all her own grandchildren, slaughters them all so that she can make herself queen and she have no rivals to the throne. And so she took power and reigned for a while, and then she was overthrown and killed. Then in chapters 12 through 16, we really just have a series of kings in Israel and Judah, as all bad ones, except for a few good ones in the north, a few good ones in Judah. And then in chapter 17, we have the fall of the northern kingdom to Assyria. So that's the end of that second division of the books of Kings, the divided kingdom. And then chapters 18 through 25, the remainder of 2 Kings, is about the surviving kingdom of Judah. And some of it is very uplifting, because it starts out by talking about Hezekiah's reign, which is a godly reign. That occupies three chapters, 18, 19, and 20. And it's a positive thing. Then there's the wicked reign of his son Manasseh, and Manasseh's son Amon, covered in chapter 21. Then in chapter 22 through chapter 23, verse 30, we have Josiah and his reforms. And he was a good king like Hezekiah, and he was actually ignorant of the law until he started a project of cleaning up and refurbishing the temple, which had fallen into poor repair. And in the course of the project, Hilkiah the priest discovered some scrolls in one of the chambers of the temple, apparently. And they didn't know what they were. It turned out to be the book of Deuteronomy, but they hadn't seen the law, apparently, for generations. They didn't even know what it was. When the priest found the book of Deuteronomy, he didn't even know what he'd found. And when he began to read it, he realized that this was something important. And so he took it to Josiah, and Josiah read it and realized that Judah was under the curse of God because of their idolatry. And so he repented for the nation and set about to bring about sweeping reforms, where he wiped out virtually all the idolatry in Judah. And that was something that the Bible says God was very pleased with, but it does say it was too little too late. It was actually very sweeping and very thorough, but it was not something that won the people's hearts. You know, a good ruler can make good laws and can ban and banish all kinds of bad behavior, but if the people aren't with him, then as soon as he's gone, they're going to go back to their old ways again. And that's pretty much what happened when Josiah died. The reform was sincere on his part, but shallow in terms of the national conscience, and did not bring about permanent righteousness in the nation, unfortunately. And then in chapter 23, verse 31 through chapter 24, we have the last several rulers of Judah who are all evil, and then that resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem and of the temple and the exile of the inhabitants of Jerusalem at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, which is in chapter 25. And just the last few verses of chapter 25 are an epilogue, sort of summarizing the spiritual significance of all of this. And so that's how the book is outlined. That's how it's divided into parts.